are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams.
Graham Nash has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice as a founding member of both the Hollies and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He's written over 200 songs, including Teach Your Children, the one that we're listening to now, and he continues to tour both as a solo artist and in various combinations of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Now he's written a memoir, Wild Tales, A Rock and Roll Life. It's published by Crown Archetype, and I'm very pleased that it's brought him to our show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
You write about growing up in Salford, England. I lived in England for a while. I've never heard of Salford.
It's a small suburb of Manchester.
And what was your childhood like?
Well, I thought it was fantastic, although I read a book recently on Salford, and it was supposed to be one of the worst slums in England.
And wasn't your father sent to prison at one point?
Yes, he was. Yes, he
for
was.
What?
He had bought a camera from a friend of his at work. And his main joy, you know, because he was a hardworking man, at the weekend he would take photographs of me and my sister. I have two sisters, but only one was born by that time. And that was his main joy. And then the police came to the door and they said that the camera had been stolen and who sold it to him. And I'm sure it's pretty much the same throughout the world, that you don't grass on your friends, you don't tell the police, you know, you just don't. And so my father wouldn't tell, and he went to jail for a year for a $30 camera.
Well, the friend should have seen what was happening.
And what?
It doesn't sound like a friend anymore.
No, he was not, no.
And then he died very young?
46.
How did that affect your family?
Drastically. You know, my father going to prison was drastic for us. I mean, we were very poor, you know, At 13 or 14 years old, I had to become the father of the house. I had to make sure that my mother and my sisters were okay, and that the door was locked and the stove was off. You know, all the basic stuff that you have to do. So I had to become a man pretty quickly.
And when did you start playing music?
When I was about 13.
Around that time?
Yeah, I've known since very early that what I wanted to do with my life.
Did your family encourage you to pursue a musical?
Absolutely,
career?
And I'll be forever grateful for them, because you were supposed to do what your dad did. You know, if it was good enough for him to go down the mine or go to the mill, then it's good enough for you, lad. Get on with it. But my mother and father never let me fall for that. This gold watch theory where you work for a company for 60 years and then as soon as you're old and decrepit, they give you a gold watch, pat you on the head, and then get somebody younger and stronger and cheaper.
But you couldn't have imagined when you founded the Hollies with Alan Clark, one of your childhood friends, that it was going to take off. There were lots of groups starting at that time in England.
Yes, there were. There was a tremendous amount of rock and roll played. Because after World War II, I mean, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids had nothing to do. Kick a ball around the street, you know, there was nothing to do. And then skiffle came along with Lonnie Donegan, who had been to America and learned all these great folk songs, brought them back to England. It was relatively cheap to be able to play skiffle if you had an acoustic guitar and a washboard for the drums and a tea chest bass. You could make music.
And then there were the people who imitated Americans. One of the big stars. Now I'm forgetting his first name, but it was Richards.
Cliff Richard?
Excuse me? Cliff Richard.
Cliff Richard, yes.
Well, it was English rock and roll was kind of empty, I might say.
It was a lot. You know, and it was the early crossover days when you had people like Fabian and Bobby Rydell and all these, you know, these 15-minute, of fame teenagers. But then serious rock and roll started to come in from Radio Luxembourg in Europe.
Because the BBC didn't play rock and roll.
They were very slow on the uptake, let's just put it that way.
So did you name the Hollies after Buddy Holly?
Mm-hmm. And it was around Christmas time, too. So, you know, there's a very famous tree, bush in England called a holly tree. And
we have the holly here,
oh,
too.
Oh, you do? Good, yes. good.
Deck the halls with boughs.
Yes, boughs of holly, yes.
And so it was Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers, that kind of music.
Indeed, you know, Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, Fats Domino, the Platters, you know, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran. Fantastic music.
When did you begin writing your own songs?
After we realized that with every single, every 45 single that you released, there was a B-side. And the B-side made just as much money as the A-side. And we realized that, you know, maybe we should put our songs on the B-side and make money.
Were the Beatles already established when you started recording?
Only by about 8 months, yes. We recorded in early 63, and they recorded in 62.
Were you playing the same clubs?
Always. There were only a certain amount of clubs, you know, certainly in Manchester and in Liverpool.
I would assume that their success helped other groups like the Hollies.
Absolutely. They opened a door, and we all ran through.
How soon after you started playing as a group did you get your first recording contract?
4 months.
And you also had to think about distinguishing yourselves from other British groups.
Yes, you had to. You had to have something to offer to the people. And one of the things about the Hollies is that they had great energy. We had great energy. We were five kids that had escaped from Manchester, and we were playing music and getting paid for it. This was a dream.
And you'd moved to London by then?
I had, yes.
This is when London was just starting to become swinging London.
Yes, that's right.
Were you part of that scene?
You could not be part of that. It was pervasive. It was all over. It was an atmosphere. It was a feeling in the air. It was a sense of freedom, a sense of we can do anything we want.
Were your big hits like Carrie Anne, Stop, 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 Bus Stop, were they as big in England as they were in the United States?
Oh, they were bigger. Absolutely.
But we just have more people buying records here.
That's true. But by the time that I left the Hollies, we'd had, I think, 16 or 17 top 10 hits.
And then you came to play in New York.
1965 in Easter at the Paramount Theater for
now,
the Soupy
this is
Sales.
The New York Paramount.
The New York Paramount. Yeah, where Buddy played and where, you know, Love Me Tender debuted. You know, that famous image of them pulling the cloth off that gigantic figure of Elvis.
Well, for most of us, it was the Brooklyn Paramount because Alan Freed used to do his shows
Indeed.
There. But that had all changed, and now it had moved to Manhattan. And there was a pretty all-star lineup.
Yeah, it was pretty big. There were, you know, we thought we were going to do our 45-minute set of Dynamite, you know. But when we got to the stage, you know, the stage manager, Bob Levine, said, you know, which two songs are you going to do? And we said, wait a second, we came all the way to America to do two songs? He said, yeah, five shows a day. And there were people like Little Richard and Shirley Ellis and King Curtis and the All-Stars. It was a great show.
The Exciters, who had a big hit with Tell 'Em.
That's right, yes.
Dee Dee Warwick.
That's right.
Dion's sister.
Yeah.
And it was produced by Morris Levy, who I always thought was something of a mobster. I don't know if he was.
Well, you know, it's Morris, but he was responsible for bringing the Hollies here, and I'll be forever grateful, even though he's passed away now.
And what were you? Well, you were working all day. Did you get a chance to see New York?
Absolutely, but mainly it was Times Square, of course. You know, and I still remember that camel ad that used to blow giant smoke rings. You know, it was fantastic coming from the north of England to New York City. It was amazing.
And the group was becoming successful, but you weren't happy. Why? What was bothering you?
Three things happened that culminated in me leaving the Hollies. One, I'd written a song in Split in Yugoslavia called King Midas in Reverse, and we made a pretty decent record of it. But it only got into the top 30, and the rest of the Hollies expected top five, right? So they began not to trust my musical direction, right? At the same time, they wanted to do an album of Bob Dylan songs, and I love Bob Dylan. He's the greatest American poet that we have. In my opinion.
You say we because you're now an American citizen?
And have been for 30-odd years, yes. I didn't want to be hypocritical. I didn't want to be criticizing this government or praising this this people and the beauty of the land without being an actual part of it. I didn't want to be throwing hand grenades in from the sidelines.
So when do you lose your accent?
Have I lost my accent?
No, when do you?
Oh, when do I? Yes. Well, I've been here almost 50 years. You know, when I go back home to England, they think I talk like a Yank.
How did you meet David Crosby and Seabird Stills?
It's a very interesting moment. You know, sometimes the smallest action that you take has ginormous implications. And what happened is that the Hollies were being thrown a party by a record company in Los Angeles. And one of the people that was there was this little 15-year-old kid called Rodney Bingenheimer, who later became a very famous DJ in Pasadena. But he was a 15-year-old Hollies fan, and he knew everything about us. And then he said, well, what are you doing after the party? And I said, I don't know, what are you doing? Which is a typical English way of answering a strange question. And he said, well, I've got these friends, and they're recording down the street. I thought you might want to go. And I said, who is it? And he said, the Mamas and the Papas. And I'd seen the album cover, you know. I mean, you know, I wanted Michelle, the same as every red-blooded American, probably. And so I went down. But Michelle and Denny and John were putting on a vocal track in the studio, and therefore I couldn't go in, of course, because the red light was on. But Cass Elliott was in the hallway, and so I became fast friends with Cass. And at the end of our conversation, she said, well, so what are you doing tomorrow? And I go, what is it with you Americans always wanting to know what we're going to do? She said, because I want to introduce you to this friend of mine. I think you might get on famously. She introduced me to David Crosby, and my life has not been the same since.
And he, at that point, was with the Birds, wasn't he?
I think he'd just been thrown out of the Birds, yes.
And then he introduced you to Stephen Stills, who was Buffalo Springfield?
Yeah, one day Crosby said, come on, we're going to go up to Peter Tork's house up on Mulholland in Los Angeles, and open the door, and there was this kid pounding the hell out of the piano in a really good boogie-woogie kind of blues kind of Latin kind of way. And Davey started to say something, and I said, wait a second, I'm just listening to this kid on the piano. He goes, well, if you'll shut up, that's Stephen Stills. I want, you know... And so I came from London to Los Angeles to Joni Mitchell's house, where I was dating Joni. And David and Stephen were there, and that's the very first time we ever sang together.
And you'd all been with other groups, so was this messy in terms of record companies and contracts?
It was in a business sense, yes. It wasn't messy because I'd heard that golden sound that we made, and I wanted it, and we all did. So the rest was just business people working out contracts with other people from record companies. They swapped me for Poco, so I was free to sign with Ahmet Erdogan, who was a dear friend of ours, the president of Atlantic Records, yes.
Well, I've wondered about the name Crosby, Stills & Nash. It's not alphabetical.
No, but it rolls off the tongue the best way. Try and say Stills, Nash, Crosby with any flourish. Go on, I dare you.
I'm not going to. And then I have to throw in Young later.
Yes, indeed.
We'll take a little break, and we'll come back with more of my conversation with Graham Nash. He's written a memoir called Wild Tales, and there are wild tales in this book from Crown Archetype, subtitled A Rock and Roll Life. I don't know how many of those wild tales we can talk about on the air. This
I know.
Is a family
some of,
program.
Some of, I know. Some of them are pretty wild.
What's your game now? Can anybody play?
Tony! You always something special to me. Quite independent, never caring. You lost your charms as you were aging. Where is your magic disappearing?
Hey, Carrie Ann, what's your game now? Can anybody play?
The sunset in your eyes, traveling the train through clear Moroccan skies, ducks and pigs and chickens call, animal carpet wall to wall, American ladies 5 foot tall and blue, sweeping cobwebs from the edges of my mind, had to get away to see what we could find, hope the days that lie ahead bring us back to where they've led. Listen not to what's been said to you.
Don't you know we're riding? on the Marrakesh Express. Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh.
We're back with Graham Nash. He's written a memoir called Wild Tales, A Rock and Roll Life. It's published by Crown Archetype. Would that be the kind of transition song for you? Because you wrote it while you were with the Hollies and then recorded it with Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
It was very much a transitional piece. I was used to writing two-minute pop songs about Moon, June, you know, back of the car kind of songs that were kind of catchy and viable, but not very profound and not very deep and not about anything really important.
Oh, I love Bus Stop.
Yeah, you know what? I did Bus Stop last night in my show and got a standing ovation for it. It was quite amazing for me. But Marrakesh Express was one of the first songs that I wrote that I thought could be a hit for the Hollies, but they didn't believe so.
You mentioned that you were getting involved with Joni Mitchell. Weren't you married at the time?
I was in the process of being divorced.
So you left your band, your wife, and your country all at the same time?
Yes, I did. I'd heard that sound, and I wanted it. And I must admit, I was quite selfish, but I wanted that sound. You know, the Byrds and the Springfield and the Hollies were good harmony bands. We knew what good harmony was. But when David and Stephen and I sang together, it was different. It was different than any one of us had heard before. And we have no claim on the notes that we sing, but when we sing together and we blend our voices around a microphone, it's a very special sound.
You found your parts immediately?
Immediately. It was whatever sound Crosby, Stills, and Nash has vocally was born in about 30 seconds.
And you opened your book at that time. Do you see it as well, obviously it was a major turning point in your life. Was it also, in your opinion, a turning point in rock and roll, a shift from England, which was for a moment anyway, the
kind of heavy metal-ish with Jimmy and Led Zeppelin and stuff, yeah.
But it was also kind of dominating the charts for the moment.
Yes, but this album that we made, the very first Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, was a very gentle album, and we knew the moment that we finished it, that it would be a smash record.
Did you each write your own songs?
Yes.
Or did you didn't collaborate?
No.
And then your first album opened with Stephen Stills' song,
yep.
Sweet Judy Blue Eyes,
yes.
Written about his relationship with Judy Collins. Was your song Our House about Joni Mitchell?
Yes. Joni and I had been to breakfast at a delicatessen in the valley in Los Angeles. On the way back to the car, past an antique store, and she saw a vase in the window that she really loved, bought it, took it back. It was one of those gray Los Angeles drizzly cold mornings. And I said, you know, I'll light a fire. Why don't you put some flowers in the vase that you just bought? And then I thought, you know, what an incredibly ordinary moment. And yet, which male has not been in a similar situation? So when Joan was in the garden trying to find flowers for the vase, I was at the piano, and Our House was written probably in about an hour.
Do they always come that easily?
No, they don't.
Because one of your other collaborators, the man who joined later, Neil Young, if I remember correctly, he wrote four or five hit songs all in one night.
It was three.
And now he hasn't written one in years and years, he says, ever since he stopped taking drugs.
Well, God bless Neil. He's an incredible musician, obviously.
How did he come to join the group, and what role did he play? I mean, because you already had worked out the harmonies and your
It's true.
Roles.
We had made that first record, and Stephen Stills, a brilliant musician that he is, played most of the music on that record, apart from the drums. I mean, Crosby and I played rhythm guitar on our stuff, you know, Marrakesh and Lady of the Island, Long Time Gone, etc. But Stephen had played bass and the B3 and the lead guitar and stuff. When we finished the album, we realized that we'd have to go out and play live. So how do we do that if Stephen played most of the instruments? So we knew that we needed another player. But it was Ahmet Erdogan at dinner one night that suggested to Stephen that he rejoin Neil Young and that Neil join the band.
Because they had been in Buffalo Springfield together.
Correct.
And Neil Young is one of the most extraordinary guitarists.
Yes, he is. Absolutely.
And you recorded songs like Ohio about the Kent State shootings. Did you think of yourself as political?
I never thought of ourselves as being political. I've always thought that we were a human band. You know, when you kill, you know, four students that have the God-given right and the constitutional right to protest what's going on, that they, you know, their government, and you shoot them. That's not political. That's humanity.
It was an interesting time because we think of it as a time of peace and love, and there was Woodstock. And you wrote the song Woodstock after the festival.
Joni did.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yes. And,
but you recorded it, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, we did. We certainly did.
And then you appeared at the Altamont Festival, mm-hmm. which was seen by many as the end of the Woodstock era.
It was the antithesis of Woodstock.
A fan was fatally stabbed by a Hell's Angel. Why do you think that those two festivals had such different results?
One of the reasons was that the in-between act music was electronic and loud and irritating. And when you play that, you know, the kind of music for a couple of hours, you know, and then, you know, you have 300,000 people waiting and waiting and waiting for the Stones. You know, the Rolling Stones were headlining that show. It just became very ugly. And you add that, the Hell's Angels, who were a little drunk and a little power crazy. And obviously, it felt bad right from the first moment.
Are you surprised that all of you have survived? I mean, David Crosby had some serious physical problems. You talk about all the drugs that you took mm-hmm. at that time.
Yes. Am I surprised? I'm not surprised that I'm alive, but I am surprised that David is. I mean, he's a Leo, but he's on his 20th life.
You're right that Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young never disbanded. So do you get together every so often?
We do. Neil called me about a week ago, and he wants Crosby, Stills, and Nash to join him at the Bridge benefit in California in the end of October.
And then you and David and Stephen also will play as a group or
No,
as duos?
It will just be the four of us, acoustic, at the Bridge benefit.
And then you also do solo gigs.
Oh, yeah, we do everything. I mean, I want it all.
You're also a photographer. In fact, the book jacket has two photos of you with a camera. One in your 20s, and then a recent one in the back,
yes.
With you looking in the mirror, and there are more of your photos in the book. How serious is photography for you?
I've been a photographer longer than I've been a musician. The first portrait in my book, Eye to Eye, of my images, is one I took of my mother when I was 10.
Oh, so you were actually taking photographs before you picked up the guitar?
Absolutely.
Do you think you played the guitar well these days?
No.
You were a rhythm guitarist always.
No, I don't. I'm part of me is not a musician. I mean, you know, I'm a writer.
Graham Nash will be giving a talk and signing books at the Union Square Barnes & Noble tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll also be at the Cornell Club on East 44th Street this Friday at 7 o'clock and at the Strand Bookstore next Monday at 7 p.m. That's on Broadway and 12th. His book... And I assume you wrote this. It doesn't suggest that there's a ghostwriter. You wrote it all yourself?
I did. I had help from my friend Bob Spitz, yes.
It's called Wild Tales. It's from Crown.